Welcome back to the Book and Film Globe podcast, the audio home companion of www.bookandfilmglobe.com, where we cover books, movies, television, streaming media, and much, much more. Our intrepid editor and host, Neil Pollack, is away this week competing and presumably winning the World Series of Poker. Doing my best to stand in for him, my name is Scott Gold, a Book and Film Globe contributor who's written on the site about everything from Stephen King to X-Men to Edgar Allan Poe, not to mention cyberpunk, vampires, and the myriad biblical parallels of The Mandalorian. We have a great show for you this week. We'll talk with contributor Stephen Garrett about puberty, friendship, and the emotional psychology at the heart or in the head of Pixar's Inside Out 2. And writer Sharon Vane will also be here to discuss Dancing with the Devil, the gripping new docuseries on Netflix that explores the dark secrets behind a TikTok dance cult. But first, we are going to talk about my personal favorite subject and one that I write about frequently for the site, Star Wars. The Acolyte is streaming on Disney Plus now, and I'm going to talk all about it with contributor Rob Kuttner right after this interlude.
This is a fight that you will not win.
She's killing Jedi. It doesn't make sense. I trained her. Now she is a student of the dark side. An acolyte.
I didn't do it!
Over at the House of Mouse, Disney Plus continues to churn out stories from a galaxy far, far away, the latest of which is The Acolyte. This new entry into the Star Wars canon gives us a tale 100 years before the events we know so well. No Skywalkers here, no Empire, and no Palpatine somehow returning. Instead, we're treated to a gripping saga set in the High Republic. We have twin sisters, one a former Jedi and another a dark assassin on a mission of vengeance, as well as a coven of Force-sensitive witches, four Jedi with a terrible secret, one of whom is a Wookiee, and most importantly, Star Wars Kung Fu. I'll be writing about the series for the site, but in the meantime, I'm pleased to welcome Emmy Award-winning television writer, Book and Film Globe contributor, and fellow Star Wars nerd, Rob Kuttner, to discuss The Acolyte. Rob, welcome to the podcast, my friend. Wow, that is a really good Chewbacca.
It's a Kelnaka. Thank you very much. It's been 1 minute to the podcast. I've already actually knew.
Yeah, I mean, I deserve it. That was great. So this is a Star Wars that is definitely different from, you know, what we consider Star Wars, or, you know, certainly people of a certain age when, you know, Star Wars was just one movie or maybe even three. You know, this is based on the era of the High Republic, which we have not yet seen in live action Star Wars, which is pretty exciting. It's existed in obviously the books and the comic books, as well as the animated show Young Jedi Adventures, but we have yet to see it on the big screen or the small screen with live human actors. So I think it's pretty cool, and it's got different colors, different costumes, different characters, new aliens, which is neat, and a whole different setting without any Skywalker stuff in it. I think it's a pretty cool concept, like doing that right now, like not, you know, straying from the whole Skywalker stuff and giving us a different era of a galaxy far, far away. What are your thoughts?
I agree. As I've written vociferously in the Book and Film Globe, I think the biggest burden to the current incarnation of the franchise is the Skywalker saga. Just either going back and trying to do it fan servicing in this kind of like perfunctory way, or rewriting the rules with every new installment. And so I'm like, the further away they can get from that, the better. And I also think it's a very interesting, as you said, like corner of the galaxy or the chronology that we haven't seen before. So I'm pretty intrigued by it.
Yeah, I think it's cool. I love, you know, having new Star Wars characters, because like, we don't know what's going to happen. Like, we know what's going to happen, you know, 100 years later. But as far as this particular story is concerned, it's all up in the air. And that, to me, is really exciting. Like anything could go on. You know, bad guys could become good guys. Good guys could become bad guys. In the first episode, we have a absolutely killer crouching tiger, hidden dragon-esque, like, tavern brawl with kung fu. Just so cool. And, you know, of course, it's starring Carrie Ann Moss as a Jedi, like echoing obviously from, you know, her role in The Matrix. And it was super neat and kind of shocking that, you know, spoiler alert here for anybody who hasn't seen The Acolyte, that she's killed off in the opening scene. And it's like, wow, man, like this is serious and definitely a little dark. I'm starting to get on the edge of my seat a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, first of all, I didn't know that Carrie Ann Moss could wear loose fitting clothes. I didn't know that was like available as a choice for her. And I agree. I like the darkness. I like how it goes hard. I like how it's already starting even by episode three to ask uncomfortable questions about the Jedi.
Yeah, absolutely.
And their quote unquote goodness. And I suspect this will be, I could be wrong, a problem for a lot of the sort of fans in the way that the polarizing favorite, The Last Jedi, was, that when you start asking questions about the good guys, some people get really mad about that. But I find it very fascinating. I think it'll make it a cooler and very distinct kind of series.
I agree. And I think it's, very interesting and smart to show, that there are maybe cracks or faults in the Jedi Order when it was at its peak, and why and how that might have led to the downfall of the Jedi down the line. And it's cool to see, you know, that maybe, you know, the Jedi Order wasn't as, you know, all noble as it professed. And, you know, I was definitely seeing echoes a little bit, you know, with, the whole concept of Jedi taking Force-sensitive children and training them to The Witcher, which is a much more violent and brutal form of that. But, that the whole idea of, you know, taking children and what that means and to families and communities. We've seen it a little bit before with Ahsoka Tano's origin story as a child, but never the deep implications emotionally of what that means to kind of rip a child away from its family and community.
Yeah, I love that the Jedi in this one is sort of like this like intergalactic child protective services all of a sudden.
Well, I mean, I think it's better than the Trade Federation and boring like economic blockades and stuff like that, you know.
That is true. That is true for sure. And I think again, like the more sort of interesting cracks in the good evil stuff. I mean, that was one of the things that was really interesting for me about Andor, was how you were sort of rooting for, I can't remember her name now, but sort of like there's a lot of divisions on the bad side of things. And then, as you said, and then a little bit of what I didn't like the book of Obi-Wan so much, it was okay. But what I liked was like anytime the sort of cracks in the bad side, and when you see the cracks on the good side, I think it's just way more textured. And just a lot more stories can be told about the sort of journeys that the characters go on.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely adds a really nice sense of emotional depth that, you know, you don't get when, you know, the good guys are cartoonishly good and the bad guys are cartoonishly bad. You know, when, you know, there's moral ambiguity, it deepens the kind of emotional connection we might have to these characters and to the story. It should serve the story. And speaking of which, the twin thing. I definitely wanted to get into this for a hot second. It is an old, old narrative trope. The good twin, evil twin, you know, going back. Like it was spoofed on The Simpsons in a famous Treehouse of Horror episode. And, you know, Star Wars is leaning into that hard. What are your thoughts about that?
It's interesting. They are. I sort of also think of this one as already a little bit like Star Wars and Frozen are melding a little bit. I also clocked the two different characters that let it go. In the first three episodes as well, but the whole sisters with too much power to handle thing. And maybe it's just part of the corporate merger. Maybe it was just one of the rules of the Disney Fox Star Wars merger. I mean, it is tropey. I think it's interesting here because the good evil stuff is like, they're already like making it a little bit murky, even like this far in, because you can introducing the backstory this far, this soon into the series is, I mean, kind of a baller move, I think. You know, I mean, it was done so famously with the original trilogy that, what, this guy has like a backstory? You know, there's something behind this like completely evil villain guy. And now they're already sort of like making you question, like, is she evil or is she just sort of like on this kind of like mission of vengeance, which we could kind of understand? You know, it's like, it's not so clear again.
Yeah. And I think that is definitely intentional. The showrunner has been quoted as saying one of the biggest inspirations of The Acolyte is the famous Akira Kurosawa movie Rashomon, in which we have three unreliable narrators, both telling of the same events from different perspectives. And I am really starting to wonder where this is going to lead, like, you know, how it's going to change things. Apparently, episode 5 is one of their favorite, and it's really going to kind of change things up. So I think we have to really kind of, you know, be cautious in buying into any narrative quite so soon in the season, because I think they're really going to turn things on its head. And if they do that, which I think they are, I think it stands to be super cool.
I think so too. I mean, and as I think you know, the creator Leslie Headland created Russian Doll. So I think she's already proven herself very adept, an acolyte, if you will, of in playing with our sense of perspectives and retelling the same narrative from different points of view or with different alternations. And I think that kind of, I'm looking forward to those kind of games being played with it.
Well, as we learned from Master Obi-Wan, it all depends on a certain point of view, right?
Yes, that's right.
The casting and acting, I think, is all really, really smart and well done here. We have, as the twins, Amandla Stenberg, who you might remember as Rue from The Hunger Games. She's playing Osha and May. And I think a real standout here is Lee Jung Jae from Squid Game as the Jedi Master Saul.
Yeah, he's got a really tough role to play with a lot of nuance. He's kind of holding everything together with like this, but with this incredible gentleness, even though he's sort of fighting a lot of forces that want to take things in a different direction. And it's kind of a tough tightrope to walk on, but he does it very well.
Yeah. And acting in English, which is not his native language, I think the speculation was that he was learning his lines phonetically, which is, talk about wow, baller moves. Like that's really, really hard to pull off. And the last time I remember anybody doing exactly that well was, I think, Antonio Banderas in Interview with the Vampire. And I think Christopher Lambert did it in The Highlander as well.
It also raises the prospect that they'll end up fighting the red light, green light doll from Squid Game 2 and is one of the big bads.
Well, you know, red lightsabers, green lightsabers, I think it'd work out really nicely, you know, same color palette.
And there's some white sabers in this too. Doesn't Yord have a white saber? Did I notice that?
I did not see that, but if he does, that would be super cool. We've only seen that, I think, with Ahsoka. That's the only one I've seen in live action, but I love different colored, you know, lightsabers. I think everybody does. And, you know, I'm just so excited to see kind of where they're going to take this. And what I really want to see is just a Wookiee, a Force Master Jedi Wookiee just kicking ass.
Yeah, they were already pretty formidable to begin with. Like they're like, you know, at least Chewbacca was like, you know, mechanically formidable, extremely powerful and strong, but then also having the Force. I mean, talk about OP. It's not even fair, really.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, super OP. Like no one in at your D&D table is going to buy so that.
I have to say, I kind of liked Ahsoka for being different, but I like this a lot more because I was thinking about like all the Star Wars TV spinoffs. And I think a really good idea is the key to it. Like, you know, this has a really good idea, the sort of murder mystery and the kind of Agatha Christie of it. And then the twins, like it has a really intriguing story. And I think Ahsoka, like I just didn't care that much about the Sabine rescuing Ezra. It felt like an iffy choice. Same thing with like Boba Fett. Like, it's like, I don't want to see Boba Fett settle down and like be a good mayor. You know, it's like the idea wasn't very strong. And here, like
right, there's
a strong story concept that's going to make it like, you can't wait to see what's going to happen next.
Yeah. And it's the unknown, which for Star Wars for me is super refreshing. Well, yeah. I will be waiting with bated breath to see how the Acolyte plays out. But in the meantime, Rob, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. I really appreciate you being here, man.
Scott, often a pleasure.
The Acolyte is streaming on Disney Plus right now, and we are going to be writing all about it on bookandfilmglobe.com. Stay tuned.
Get on your feet and make some noise! Seriously, hold me! I wish I was as tall as you.
I'm Ellie.
Yeah, yeah. We're going!
Free emotion is good for all. Be okay, right?
50-50.
Disney Pixar is no stranger to sequels. They gave us 3 Cars movies, a pair of Incredibles, 2 Monsters, Inc.s, and a soon-to-be 5 Toy Stories, amongst others. For its most recent foray into franchise continuation, Pixar decided not to choose bugs or fish or talking vehicles, but rather a single, very emotional girl named Riley. Yes, I'm talking about Inside Out 2, which was just released in theaters. It follows a now 13-year-old Riley as she enters the terrors and pitfalls of puberty, and along with it arrive a host of new emotions to join joy, anger, sadness, fear, and disgust from the first film. In an ocean of animated features starring everything from Transformers to Kung Fu animals, supervillains and their hilarious yellow minions, can a story about feelings, and a sequel no less, really make a meaningful impact? Here to talk about Inside Out 2 is Book and Film Globe contributor Stephen Garrett, who wrote about the movie for this site. Stephen, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thank you. Which emotion is running your brain right now?
Deadline.
Is it anxiety? It's anxiety, isn't it?
Probably
it's
fear.
It's the new one that we've just learned is fear. Rage is mine.
All of it. All of the emotions intertwined, which is actually what this movie is about. Yeah. It's about all the feels.
Yeah.
So just tell us a little bit about where we left off with the last movie and kind of what is new and different in this one as Riley graduates from being a tween to being a teen.
Yeah, you know, the first one was about these so-called core emotions, which I think if you look at child development, child behavioral psychology, they talk about these kind of five flavors, right? Which were joy, sadness, rage, fear, and what's the other one? God, oh, disgust. And these are emotions that help you form core memories, and the core memories become what they called in the first movie personality islands. And so these core memories define who you are. So Inside Out 2, they've added some new emotions. We now have, what do we have? Ennui and envy and anxiety and embarrassment. I think it's just those four. And now we have moved on or developed, because now Riley's hitting puberty and the mind is growing and can process more complex emotions and ideas. And there is now something called belief systems that are forming. What they call belief systems in terms of, it's kind of some mix of core memories with, I guess, some essence of yourself. And so the new emotions basically threaten that belief system to the point where they start to change that belief system and in turn change Riley's real sense of herself is. And that is the crux and the conflict of the movie, because joy and the other original emotions have been banished from the control room and anxiety is taking over more and more. And it is warping our poor little Riley and her sense of self.
I think, you know, honestly, as I don't know how you describe it, I guess like a metaphorical depiction or an anthropomorphic depiction of, like, you know, the mental process of an adolescent or a teenager. It is shockingly effective. And I think they probably did a lot of homework into behavioral psychology and, you know, how the mind works in order to kind of make it feel like really real. Like this is a system that has rules that can, you know, that are important and they can be broken. And which is important for any kind of sci-fi fantasy thing. And this is, in essence, it's a little bit fantasy, right? You know, these characters living in our heads.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I really, like, it was really, really successful and smart writing to bring in Maya Hawke as Anxiety. Ayo Edebiri from The Bear was awesome as Envy. And to bring those in and basically have Anxiety kind of running her life. And, you know, it's something that I think people can immediately connect with because we know what that emotion feels like, especially for a 13-year-old.
Absolutely. I think it's the strength and weakness of the movie. And I kind of wrote about this to a certain extent, but this I didn't write about. I think the strength of the movie is that in a day and age when people, I think, are in touch with their emotions, maybe more willing to talk about their emotions, here's a movie that's actually explaining your emotions and how they affect how you interact with the world and how different people in the world affect your emotions. So I think, you know, especially when you're 13 years old, like Riley is, and you discover that your closest friends are moving to another school, and now suddenly you're in a situation where you need to start making new friends, that is a certain level of anxiety. I think certainly kids that age don't know how to unpack. And here's a movie that's literally unpacking it for them. And I mean, hats off to Disney for making a movie like that so that a 12-year-old, a 9-year-old, a 15-year-old can see it broken down in that way that they can easily digest and actually understand so that they can control what is happening to them as it happens. You know, I think that's kind of amazing. My little kind of like grumpy old man reaction to that as well is, oh, that's a shame. It's very reductive, you know, just to say, well, people are these few emotions and people are the result of the interaction of these certain emotions with whatever predicament you're in. And that's basically the essence of who you are. And I just don't believe that. I mean, I think life is much more mysterious than that.
Yeah, I agree. It is definitely a little bit reductive, but I think part of that is that it needed to be, if the movie were to try and anthropomorphize the entire host of human emotions, like there would be too many voices in the room. Like, it's just too complicated. There's too much going on. So I think in the interest of, you know, good storytelling, it was, I think, the right decision to say, okay, we'll bring in four emotions. We don't have to bring in 40.
Right.
Otherwise, it's not a movie. It's just, you know, chaos.
But the thing is, too, it's like you start to unpack it a little bit. And, you know, on the one hand, you do see these emotions start to have other emotions. Like you see joy, sad. You see, you know, you see rage kind of chilling out. You see, you're like, suddenly these emotions aren't necessarily sticking to book in terms of being a one specific emotion. And I think it's the demands of storytelling that require characters and not archetypes, you know, in order to tell a story. And I think that's where it starts to fall apart. I think it's also kind of interesting. Did you notice that the parents, do you go into their heads and you see the emotions and it's just the original five emotions? You don't really see that many of the other emotions. Maybe they like anxiety pops up in the dad form, but clearly these other emotions are hidden away somewhere. And then
right.
It is like, I'm assuming Inside Out 3 is going to introduce even more emotions. And then where are they in terms of the parents' heads? Like, they got to explain that. I don't know. It starts to, also, this fell into sequelitis in the sense of like, we are going to exile Joy from the control room and she's going to spend the whole movie trying to get back to the control room. And it is literally that again. And she is literally going through, you know, like, what is it? Imagination land. She's literally hanging off of cliffs, falling, you know, trying to get into tubes that take her in and out of places. You know what I mean? It just felt literally like a retread.
Yeah, there was definitely that element of it. And it was a retread. She's crossing all of this, you know, the vast landscape of Riley's mind. And there's no bing bong.
Right.
Like, come on, man. Like, you're not going to.
Well, did you see it? Did you see the bing bong Easter egg?
I did not see the bing bong Easter egg. Tell me about it.
My daughter found it. It's really cute. It's like maybe 10 or 15 minutes into the movie. Do you remember that scene where the original five emotions, before the new emotions come in, you see the original five sleeping in their kind of like dorm room?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost like, what do you call it? Bunk beds. And each bunk bed has like little tchotchkes like on the shelf. Like sadness has like a box of Kleenex. Joy's little shelf has like a little miniature bing bong. With the rocket, you know, what you call it? The what do you call that little? It's not a sled.
It's like his wagon. The wagon.
His wagon. Exactly. Yeah. I was going to say like a radio flyer or whatever. It's like a wagon. But you know what? Funny you bring up Bing Bong. It was funny. I watched Inside Out again before seeing the sequel because it had been since 2015 since I had seen it. So it'd been 9 years. And for the life of me, I really couldn't remember very much from the movie except for Bing Bong. Bing Bong, I totally remember Bing Bong. And guess what? Bing Bong is not an emotion. Bing Bong is not explained. Bing Bong is somebody who they show, they do not tell. You know, Bing Bong is an imaginary friend. And that whole journey about how Bing Bong sacrifices himself in his own way, I don't want to spoil it too much, but it's a really beautiful scene. And nothing has to be explained in that scene. And I think that's the fault of these movies. The more you explain something, the less mysterious and profound it is, and the less it's really going to impact us in the long term. In the short term, I couldn't agree more. This movie is incredibly delightful. It's wonderful. It's funny. It's witty. It's charming. You know, it moves at a rapid clip. It's very entertaining. But I feel like it just kind of went through it. I was bathed in it. And I don't know how much more I'm going to think about it afterwards. Whereas in Inside Out, I kind of had the same problem, except for Bing Bong, which was very sticky. Because I think it touched me in a way that I couldn't explain and that the movie didn't explain. And I was so grateful that the movie didn't reduce it that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree that was missing. But, you know, it is a little bit of sequelitis, I think. But overall, I think they made a really, really compelling movie. And I won't lie. I don't know if this is because
I'm getting a little bit older because, you know, I have a four-year-old son and my emotions are heightened, but, you know, there were some tears. Like I am not afraid to say that it definitely emotionally and manipulated me in that way, which is ironic, right?
Right. But, you know, in all the best ways too. And also, you know,
it's absolutely.
And the thing is, it is a retread. It's got the same message. The same message is you cannot repress feelings. You've got to let feelings, you know, be what they are. You've got to let them breathe inside of you. You've got to let them vent. You can't push them down. And I think that
you can't literally put them in the bottle,
literally. You can't bottle
and there's them some up. Fun, you know, before we go, I just want to say that there are some really fun, puns and plays on words. There is a literal stream of consciousness. There is a sarcasm.
That's fantastic.
Eventually there's the weather turns and it's, oh no, it's a brainstorm.
It's a brainstorm full of really bad ideas. I know. I'm like, I can't fault it. I dinged it a little just because it's a retread and because of these reductive things. But you're right. I mean, just as a primer, especially for children, young adults who are going through a lot of different emotional changes and don't quite understand it, what could be better than either or both of these movies, frankly, you know? I think they're really great. But it goes back to the very first thing you said introducing this, which is all these sequels that Pixar used to do. Pixar very famously refused to make sequels, mm-hmm. you know, because they wanted every movie to be completely original. They broke their own rule when they made Toy Story 2 kind of early on. They broke it again when they eventually made Cars 2. And then it was like the dam burst. And they're like, let's just make sequels to everything because we're owned by Disney now and we have stockholders and quarterly reports to make. And it's a shame.
Yeah. It's exactly like the flood of sequels is like the flood of emotions in this movie, right? All new ones coming in, tearing things up. Stephen Garrett, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
My pleasure.
Stephen's piece on Inside Out 2, his review is up on the site right now. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks, man.
I don't even know where to start. Today is my sister's birthday. We're not allowed to contact her and we're blocked on absolutely everything.
We have two daughters. We don't just have one.
All the dancers that she danced with, someone else is controlling their lives.
I don't want to say I was in a cult.
How did I let myself get sucked into something like that?
When you think about TikTok and dancing, you probably think of the largely innocuous, insanely popular trend that's seen everyone from tweens to grannies doing the wobble and the Tootsie slide on the social media site. But of course, there's a dark side to the fad. And when there's a dark side, you just know Netflix is going to catch on and throw a salacious documentary about it our way, which is exactly what you'll find in Dancing with the Devil, the recent 3-part docuseries that chronicles how a number of talented, eager young dancers got hoodwinked into joining a cultish congregation known as 7M or the Shekinah Church. It is a lurid and heart-wrenching tale of broken families, twisted faith, the lust for fame, terrifying abuse, and yes, dancing. Book and Film Globe contributor Sharon Vane wrote about the series for the site, and she's here to chat with us about it. Sharon, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. It is all that and more. It's quite a mishmash of a lot of different topics and themes and genres, but it works all together.
So for people who might not have seen it, I've caught the first 2 episodes and didn't quite manage to finish it before I fell asleep last night. But it is fairly gripping and really slickly produced. So why don't you just tell us a little bit broadly about what the series is about?
Well, to really understand the documentary, there's a 3-episode docuseries. You have to understand the world of these TikTok dancers. So, you know, you see lots of regular people doing dances on TikTok, but these dancers are professionals and, you know, they've been on television shows like, you know, The World of Dance and done lots of competitions. They're professionals. These are slickly produced little videos. And I went down the rabbit hole a couple of years ago and started following a bunch of them when I was in COVID quarantine because I saw the entire internet over those 10 days. Right. And that was when I started to really, you know, I found these little videos appealing. And then come to find out that, you know, some of the stars of these videos, they're all connected and they all belong to this Shekinah Church, which some of the family members of the dancers say is a cult, because as soon as these dancers join the church, they tend to cut off contact with their families and only see other people in the church, give a significant amount of their money to the church. And it's like every cult story you've ever heard, except the people involved are also producing content on a regular basis.
It really is like a 21st century cult story. Like, we haven't had this yet. I mean, you look, you know, back to, you know, going back to any cult covered in modern media, from Jonestown to David Koresh, Heaven's Gate, all of those. I mean, they clearly have the same elements involved. And now with the internet and social media, there is a new like twist to how these cults operate and how they make money and how they can, you know, the charismatic leader can control the people in his, you know, flock. And it's just, it's intriguing and it's, you know, salacious and it's gripping and it's just wholly terrifying, because it's like no detail is unspared, because these people are just sharing everything on social media and just seeing this like dark underbelly and hearing some of the people that came out of this dance troupe, like telling like what was going on behind the scenes. It's like, it makes your skin crawl.
Well, it's such a classic story of people wanting fame and then finding it in a way that forces them to give up parts of themselves. And just all of the twists and turns, kind of as you pointed out, have been broadcast on social media. A key dancer that the documentary focuses on is Miranda Derrick, who is this, you know, beautiful, you know, blonde dancer who used to do a lot of TikTok online dancing with her sister. And the two of them danced together. Miranda moved out to LA, met her now husband, who's a member of the church. And that's when she started to break off. And her family actually went on Instagram Live and did this whole sort of plea to the dance community to tell them what was going on with this church, which is how the documentary producers and directors first found out about it. And they spent a couple of years with some of these families, and we sit with them and hear, I mean, it's really heartbreaking to see this dad watching home movies of his daughter, who now won't even talk to him because she says she's given her life to God and she needs to, you know, set boundaries with people that don't believe the same things that she does.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that really got me is, you know, the production is very slick. Like, it is a very like visually appealing series, the way they integrate social media. You know, it's a real challenge for filmmakers to, you know, tell a, what is essentially a social media story in a, you know, a much older format of, you know, we call it film, but it's really, you know, just television. But still, like, the, you know, the way that they incorporate the text messages and the reels and, you know, the dances and like they pull everything together. It's really smartly done.
Well, you feel like you're there for a lot of it. And in some of the interviews I read with the producers and directors of the film, they wanted to focus less on the charismatic pastor of Shekinah Church, Robert Shin, who's kind of the bad guy, the villain in this docuseries, and much more on his victims and the family. And so you kind of feel like you're a member of this family, seeing the text go back and forth, seeing some of, you know, these very slickly produced videos, and the dancers, you know, how they're creating content. They're going, you know, to these different locations, and we're there in the car when they're driving up to the gates of this invite only church to see if they can talk with their daughter. It is very well done, I think, in large part, because they had such access to the family, and they've said that was really a key piece for them in making the docuseries. They wanted to focus on the people left behind rather than the, you know, bad guy running the church.
You know, I completely agree that it's, you know, that gives it a real sense of immediacy and makes you really feel like you've entered into these people's lives in you know, just a really intimate way. But at the same time, you know, it's a little bit strange. It's almost like a reality show more than a documentary, because we're seeing the events of the documentary unfold in real time as the producers and cameramen and every, you know, everybody, you know, record the, you know, the family trying to get their daughter exfiltrated from this culty church. And it's not something that I know that I've seen before, like that level of immediacy in a television show.
Well, it's really, you know, one of the things I say in the review is that we don't really have any resolution at the end of the docuseries, in part because there isn't been a resolution. They're following along in real time with this drama of these, you know, these families. You know, Miranda Derrick is kind of probably the most famous person in the TikTok dancers, but the docuseries also focuses on another pair of sisters who were members of this church several decades ago when it first started. And the access they got, I mean, we see these sisters talking just as really like heart-wrenching conversations about the trauma that, you know, one was in the church for longer than the other. The one who was in the church suffered and how it's affected her life. And I mean, we see her confronting her father in, you know, like South Korea about how he let her, you know, go into this church. I mean, it is grueling and heartrending and absolutely gripping. You just, in some ways, can't believe that they've given the filmmakers this much access, but it makes it such a compelling watch because of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that I had going on in my head was knowing that there wasn't any real resolution, was that going to affect kind of how the narrative plays out? And my thoughts are that, you know, even though there's not a resolution, it's still really, really gripping television. And I still feel that it's meaningful and it's a really good watch, even though it doesn't have a traditional quote unquote ending.
Well, I think it's got a couple things going for it. So many people follow these dancers. And so you kind of have these parasocial relationships with them. You're like, I know Miranda Derrick. I didn't know she was in a cult. And then you meet these other families and you kind of, you know, see the roller coaster of emotions that they're going through. And, you know, we've seen these cult stories before, but this is certainly a modern take on it. And it also really sounds that theme of, you know, we talk a lot about you've got one face on social media and quite another in the real world. And this absolutely illustrates that perfectly, because even today I saw videos from some of the players involved and you would have no idea that this drama is going on behind the scenes from all these family members. So it's, it makes you think.
Absolutely. And another thing that I was surprised about was, and I honestly, like, I don't know a lot about TikTok. I'm not like a TikToker. Like, my, you say the words TikTok and my eyes glaze over, you know, because I'm just like, you know, nerdy 47-year-old, you know, dad. It's like not even my bag, but the series is really gripping. And the one thing that really I was shocked is how great the dancing is. I mean, they are so talented.
Well, that's how they get all these, this following. I mean, I'm almost embarrassed to say that when I first heard about this docuseries, and I was like, Miranda Derrick. And then I was like, oh, her husband. Oh, this other one, these other ones that are all in videos with each other. And you realize that they lay it out. Oh, they're all part of kind of the same content farm. And their videographer is the son of the church pastor. So there's all these connections, but they are amazing dancers. I mean, they're, you know, I mean, for a minute and 30 seconds, you're watching them dance as a couple, dance as a group, dance solo. They've got different costumes. They've got different backdrops. I mean, it's awesome. And then we also see some of the dancers that have escaped the church. They have kind of interludes in the series and, you know, they've got kind of their own, we see them dancing in different formats, some just for these films. The filmmakers, and some after they've escaped, they've gotten to have some pretty amazing experiences on stage. I don't want to ruin it for the viewers because there's kind of like a big reveal at the end for what one of the dancers has gone on to. So you have to watch to the end of the third episode to see that, but it's well worth the watch.
Well, I think even though I haven't finished it, I am completely pulled in and I can't wait to see whatever happens. And in the meantime, for our listeners, you can find Sharon's piece on Dancing with the Devil up on Book and Film Globe right now. And you should read it because it is great. And Sharon, thank you so much for being here on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
That about wraps it up for the podcast this week, my friends. America's greatest living writer, Neil Pollack, will return to host next week, assuming he doesn't take the Scrooge McDuck-sized mountain of gold he's won in the World Series of Poker and move to Monte Carlo or Dubai. But for now, it's been a real pleasure once again taking the helm of this pod. I want to thank Rob Kuttner for chatting about The Acolyte, but more importantly, for his always welcome wit, writerly perspicacity, and one bangin' Wookiee impression. Thanks also to Stephen Garrett for talking with us about Inside Out 2, which you'll find in movie theaters now, and his deeply insightful review of the film is on our website. Contributor Sharon Bain's full exegesis of everything TikTok dance cult is also on the site, and you should definitely check that out. Many thanks to Sharon for her lively thoughts on Dancing with the Devil, which you can find streaming on Netflix. Thanks for checking into the podcast for Book and Film Globe. That's www.bookandfilmglobe.com. Our fearless leader, Neil Pollack, will return with more adventures in pop culture next week. In the meantime, I've been your guest host, Scott Gold, saying, may the force be with you, live long and prosper, be excellent to each other, so say we all, and may the odds be ever in your favor. Take care, folks.
Original production.